right. So first of all, I wish to thank the organizer for giving me so much time. So there's lower chance that we'll go overtime, but one never knows. So this is, first of all, this is the first of three talks. So this first talk tries to be kind of introductory, and will be somewhat vague maybe, and the second and third will be more specific. So let me try to explain what I'm interested in and what are the results I'm aiming for. So first of all, we have to do essentially what renormalization can do in studying parabolic flows. So, but this will be kind of a very basic level, in the sense that I don't want to call it parabolic renormalization for obvious reasons. So parabolic flows here will be just some examples of flows are mostly homogeneous. In some sense, which have low polynomial divergence. Divergence of trajectories. And for me, actually, I should say at most. So my example here will include linear, total linear flows, but I have nothing new to say about this. So it's included as a kind of trivial special case. The second case will be suspensions over inter-exchange transformation. And for short, I will always kind of call this inter-exchange transformations, even though I'm really looking at suspension. So this is the only non-homogeneous case I'm looking at. And third, all cycle flows. Constant curvature, surfaces and constant curvature. And, well, there is another example . Okay, so these are examples, and for all these examples one can do the same thing, and you know, I will tell you what is the result, and I'll try to explain what is the heuristic. I mean, this is not a theory, there is no general theorem, it's just there's an heuristic that says, in order to obtain certain kind of result about deviation of ergodic averages, we can do the same thing in all these cases.
Yeah.
Homogeneous? Okay, an homogeneous flow, you just take a Lie group, take a quotient of the Lie group, and then take a flow which is given by a one-parameter subgroup of the Lie group. So maybe I should say, well, Heisenberg new flows this means that we take the Heisenberg group and take a lattice, take a quotient, and then take one-parameter subgroup. And this, I shouldn't need to say anything about this. And the orthocycle flows are correspond to SL2R. So this is the phase space, and then there is the orthocycle vector field, the so-called unipotent subgroup of SL2R that gives the orthocycle flows. So it's H. So it's okay. So I will say something about motivation after I state the kind of the result. So let me say that this is what everything I'm going to say is basically taken from Fourier exchange transformation paper on ANNA's in 2002. Then there is some outline in the ICM talk, also 2002. And then there is papers, two papers with Livio Flaminio, so it's from Lille. And this is to appear. And well, there is some work in progress, but I'm not going to talk about work in progress because I don't feel confident about until it's written. Okay, so so maybe this is a bad choice of doing this here. So maybe I will erase this, and I will put my statement here. Oh no, maybe I have some comments that I wanted to make. So okay, so what is, just have a flavor about the dynamics of these systems. So what do we expect? Well, for all these systems, it's known that they're typically uniquely ergodic. So this is I should quote for each system who proved. But if I start doing that, maybe it will, you know, take a lot of time. And well, in particular, well, and for a smooth volume form, so they're also minimal. And then one can ask the questions about about unique ergodicity. I should mention that there is a, in the homogeneous case, there is a whole theory, so Ratner's theory for unipotent flows, so a unipotent flow is a homogeneous flow with a linear action essentially as only one as an eigenvalue. So it's Delos cycle is a basic baby example. So this theory tells a lot about classifying invariant measures and can be used to prove unique ergodicity, you know, when this is true. I mean, it's not always true, of course, in general for unipotent flows, but it can be used to prove unique ergodicity in examples. So one question would be to this quantitative. So this is what I'm aiming for. So, well, I'm not so bold in saying that I'm aiming for a general quantitative Ratner's theory, but at least to see what renormalization can do in some cases. So it's, if we can try to prove estimates, we have unique ergodicity, we have uniform convergence of ergodic averages, and the idea would be to prove estimates on the speed of convergence. So let me put here also some other remark. So I will be mostly interested in properties which are independent on time of time changes. There are other properties like weak mixing and also mixing that, of course, are heavily depending on time change. And well, depending on the system, they are true or false. For instance, for Heisenberg niche flows, weak mixing is false. And well, I'll mention here that in a paper with Artur, we have shown that weak mixing for typical suspensions over AT. So for suspensions, but I'm not going to talk about that. And this is also proof that uses renormalization. About mixing, what one would expect is that at least for some time change of the original flow, the answer is yes, with polynomial decay. And in some sense, the property that I'm going to put on the blackboard now, it can be conceived as some sort of a trace of the mixing with polynomial decay. Of course, mixing with polynomial decay will be dependent on time change. And the property I'm going to put forward is the deviation of ergodic averages is independent of time change. So the two, I mean, this is kind of a, I don't know if, in some cases it's certainly true. Like for instance, for the recycle case, this is certainly true. For other cases, an open question whether you can find a time change which makes the system mixing with polynomial decay. So let me put here sort of a kind of definition that is actually the property I would like to prove. So let's take a flow phi tv on some manifold, and I will take this compact, but it doesn't have to be. And we say that this flow has a deviation spectrum if for sufficiently smooth f function on M. Let's see. So let's try to write this in a. Well, I should actually make some more assumptions on the flow. As I said, I should add that the flow will be uniquely ergodic and it will preserve a smooth volume form. And for this f, if we look at the ergodic integral, this will be this is a very rough way of writing this, but okay, something like this. So I have to tell you many things about this. Well, this is essentially this is about having a as precise asymptotics as possible. Arthur looks puzzled. Yeah. So having as precise asymptotics as possible with bounds on these quantities, these exponents are supposed to be positive. So I have to write all this. But essentially, you can think of this as a sort of precise form of speed of ergodicity, for instance. And so what we want to have here is that, well, first of all, the lambdas, let me write this from 2 to infinity just for. So lambda 1 is going to be 1, and then I'll have. The only thing I want is that these are positive. And then from the coefficients, I want what the goal is to get. Bounded for all times. And also R. Oh, there is F here. so this is R also. Bounded for all time. And as for lower bounds, a good lower bound would be to prove that, well, at least from my point of view, a good lower bound would be to prove the L2 norm of this coefficient is bounded below by some positive constant, or at least that they are bounded below on a subsequence. For every point, there is a subsequence for which these coefficients are bounded. Lower bounds are usually kind of more difficult than upper bounds. So, I also have to say that this coefficient dk are V invariant distributions. So I will probably say later what is a V invariant distribution. It's, for the moment, it's just simply some linear function on smooth functions. So V is the vector field. V is the generator. Of course, let's see, what do I want to say? I think this is okay. Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. No. No, it's not bounded either. I mean, yes, exactly. I have to specify what this means. So you can take this in the asymptotic sense. So you can say, okay, you stop at a certain point, and then the rest will be bounded by some power. Or you can sum the, in some cases you can actually make sense of the series. But I have to specify that in examples. We see the following situation, that the lambda k's are a finite number. So it depends on how you want to write this. You know, you can think that actually some numbers will be repeated infinitely many times. So the lambda k's are a finite number of distinct, but with except for interval extension transformations, some will have infinite multiplicity. And for some reason that I certainly do not understand. In the example, the lambda that has infinite multiplicity is actually always equal to 1/2. So maybe there is something behind this. 1/2 is, but you know, this is just a few examples. So it's the lambda which has infinite multiplicity is actually 1/2. 1/2, of course, with infinite multiplicity in the Heisenberg case and in the orthocycle case. Yes, lambda equal to 1/2. The lambda is equal to 1/2 is the only lambda that occurs in this statement, which has infinite multiplicity. In the Heisenberg case, the only one, and there's only lambda 1/2 with infinite multiplicity. And in the orthocycle case, there are a bunch of other lambdas bigger than 1/2, and then there is 1/2 with infinite multiplicity. In the orthocycle case, yes. In the Heisenberg case, no. So, but you know, how these lambda come up and what they are, I guess we'll come later. So, okay. So the idea is to prove this for these flows and possibly for more flows, if we can. I cannot for the moment. I have some ideas, but and some work in progress, but. These are the cases that I can do and they are written down. Well, what happens is that you can formulate what you can say is that actually the that series, so you take the one half outside, okay, that series converges actually and gives you some distribution in with value in some no, it gives you some distribution. So you can sum this, you can take the T one half outside and sum the series. It will give you some linear, some well defined linear functional on smooth functions that depends on will depend, since there are the coefficients will depend on x and t, but it will be bounded. So yeah, so this is maybe not, I mean, it's kind of a rough way of writing it. There is no problem with the summation, so this is not an issue. I mean, if you prefer, you can just take it into a kind of asymptotic sense that you just can if you have only one half, you can say that the difference is bounded by some constant times t to one half. Yes. So this little of one is wants to be a logarithmic correction. Of course, the amount of technical work that you're willing to put to prove that it's a logarithmic correction depends on whether I know whether it is or not. So the easier case where we were very kind of energetic, and since it's easier, we can get much sharper results, is the Lo-cycle case. In the Lo-cycle case, we have the upper bound and the lower bound match so well, then well, let me mention as a corollary or a cycle. So this is works for this case. CLT is false, so central limit theorem doesn't hold, and it doesn't hold in a very precise way. First of all, it has nothing to do with the fact that you cannot normalize by square root. You normalize the way you are supposed to normalize, but all limiting distributions are like this. So compact support, and what I'm trying to say with this picture is that they are compact support and they are not concentrated at zero. So apparently this came as a surprise, but I don't know, I have no idea. So it's due to the fact that the upper bound and the lower bound are really matching so well that, you know, if you can just compute that wherever limit you, this limiting distribution you have has to be this. By the way, I don't know if there are limiting distributions. I suspect that there are not, but I cannot prove this. So let me put forward other motivations. Well, so as I said, I cannot prove this in other cases, and the reason is that the little of one is not very much under control for interval sense transformations, and it's just a little of one. And for Heisenberg case, we were even lazier, and although we could do it, we didn't prove lower bounds. So the lower bound for Heisenberg is actually not written. So could be written, but I mean. Okay. So motivation. So first of all, so this is. This is some sort of funny story, in a sense, that the first case that was considered is the case of interval-sense transformations, and this is related to what is called sometimes the Zollich phenomenon and Zollich conservative conjectures for interval-sense transformations. That essentially, first, Zollich put forward conjectures and partially proved them, not for the ergodic behavior of trajectory of suspension of interval-sense transformations, but for the homological type of trajectories. So just essentially take this theorem and replace smooth function with closed forms, on a surface. And then you have just you're just controlling the topological behavior of trajectories. And he said, well, it looks like things are going like that, and he built up an explanation with some conjectures that to make it complete. And then Konsevich, in a paper that is essentially a joint paper, they put forward that actually for all smooth functions this should be true. And I remember when I read that, it was very, to me, were kind of mysterious how comes that this is true. But the funny part is that so the one motivation was to generalize this. So how far can we generalize the Zoritz-Konsevich picture to other systems? And the funny part is that actually it gave applications for homogeneous dynamics, which in some sense is much easier, and proved the result that other people were trying to prove for cycle flow more or less at the same time, for instance. And that for me is one motivation. So just to give a little list of applications and some history. So for Oro cycles, there have been interest in number theory because of a quite well-known connection between the equidistribution of scattered Oro cycles on the modular surface and the Riemann hypothesis. I mean, I'm not, of course, not saying that this has any chance of whatever saying anything about the Riemann hypothesis. So let me be clear on that. But nevertheless, these people, Sarnak, I think, is in the 80s, proved the result about the equidistribution of cuspid Oro cycle that really looked like that. The only difference is that you take the cuspid Oro cycle, you push it with the geodesic, and then you prove some asymptotics for how it equidistributes. And the asymptotics exactly looks like that. So this is some reference to this. And then there were trying to prove stronger results for all orbits. There were results by Burger, and more recently by Strombergson and Markov. So the motivation of all these people, I guess, is closer to number theory, but they don't have distributions, they don't have asymptotics, they only have upper bounds. So. So for instance, CLT is false, they cannot get because they lack lower bounds for the Oro cycle. I mean, they cannot get this. And for nil flows, so first of all, let me mention that I will explain this later. Let me mention that the normalization for the Eisenman nil flows is sort of a new thing. I mean, in some sense, it wasn't, as far as I know, was never considered before, and it was discovered independently. So renormalization discovered independently in some sort of slightly different form by Jens Markov. And what is it good for? Well, this is good for quantitative, so this is a kind of classical problem in number theory, is the quantitative equidistribution of, say, well, in general, nk alpha mod 1. But you want estimates. So the case that we can do is the case k equal to 2 that corresponds to Eisenberg. And it's the one that we are able to renormalize. In higher degree, as I try to explain in following talks, we don't know how to renormalize, so we are not sure we can. And we're in the process of trying to make it work, but there is a striking difference between the results that are available in the literature and number theory literature in the case 2 and in the higher case, So the case k equal to 2 goes back to R.D. Littlewood. I think in something like 1914, they had a proof of upper bounds which is not quite optimal, and it took until Fiedler, Jourcat, Körner in 1977 to actually give a number theoretical optimal proof. So what we did with Livio was to give a dynamical system proof under this philosophy, I mean under the method, the heuristics that I will explain, of essentially the optimal result. But for k bigger than 2, I'm not going to mention here the results that are available. I'm not an expert also, but they are much, much weaker, and there is no idea what are the optimal ones. So this is an interesting direction to at least. Excuse me? If f is real valid?
My answer is,
If there is some imaginary component, well, I mean this is kind of there are these coefficients, so it's you just prove bounds.
No.
No, you in the orthocycle case, yes. In the orthocycle case, you have exactly the, you have precisely the spectrum.
You can.
I think so. Yeah. I don't know what to do with that. Maybe you do some. I don't know. Maybe it's useful. Okay. So I'll now start trying to explain what is the idea. So why those flows? Why those flows and not other flows? Of course, where is this? So this comes to the fact that we're trying to do something very simple. I'll decide today to call algebraic normalization. So this theorem is like, okay, we are trying to prove the Jouett-Cauchemann for rotation of the circle, and we have continuous fraction expansion. Now, we like to do the same when we don't have continuous fraction expansion. We still have a renormalization. So, as I mentioned, in all cases we have renormalization. For total linear flows, we have, of course, continuous fraction expansion dimension 2 or the geodesic flow on the modular surface. For suspensions over interface transformation, we have the Tech-Mueller flow or the Rossi induction. For the cycle flows, we have the geodesic flow. And for Eisenman, new flows, something that I will have to explain, which is very simple. It's no big thing. So what is the idea of algebraic normalization? It's simply that, we are looking at flows. So we have this manifold. And so geometrically, we are looking at some long trajectory. And we like to produce the long trajectory by sort of a deformation of the manifold. So we take the manifold, we stretch it in the direction of the orbit foliation, and up to a diffeo, up to change of coordinates, these two things will be the same. Well, a long piece of orbit and a short piece of orbit. We should have a family of manifolds. If you in the special case of orthocycle, you have just one fixed manifold, and you have a geodesic that takes a short orbit into a long orbit. In general, you don't have such a simple situation. You have to think, for instance, in the case of the torus, you take a torus and you deform it, making one direction very long and the other short. And you get a deformed torus. Up to this, you get a deformed torus, and the torus might degenerate. So the ingredients are some control way of deforming the structure of the manifold, and some moduli space of manifolds, which contains sufficiently rich, and the hope that the moduli space is finite dimensional, and you can control this renormalization dynamics. Now, this is so it's some kind of a geometric deformation. And when I say geometric deformation, of course, one of the things that are going to play a role is really the deformation of the geometry. The deformation of the geometry is responsible for the little log one. So if there is no deformation of geometry, then the little log one is essentially not there. So what do all these examples have in common? So this is probably trivial. So I'm kind of I'm half ashamed to tell you about this. All these examples in common. So this was the attempt of saying, okay, what do they have in common? So let's try to see what they have in common to try to generalize. So what they have in common is that the manifold M has a frame that contains our vector field. So a frame, I will call the frame something like x1, xn. Of course, the dimension is either 2 or 3, so n is equal to 2 or to 3, as a frame of a tangent bundle that is actually gives a representation of a finite dimensional Lie algebra. So meaning that if you take the commutators, then you have some constants, and so you have this is the basic structure that is used. So not only that, the basic mechanism for deforming is given by some automorphism of the Lie algebra. So it's very special, and it's not so surprising that it's not easy to generalize very much because it's very special. So essentially, renormalization is defined by some appropriate, I will say in a minute what is appropriate, automorphism of the Lie algebra. So the idea is that we consider all manifolds of a certain type with have a frame, and the frame will correspond to a certain Lie algebra, and then if we have some appropriate automorphism of the Lie algebra, we are in business. So what is the automorphism doing? Well, it's not very mysterious. So we have V now is an element of our Lie algebra. We say that this is okay. So if we can find a one-parameter group of automorphisms, it doesn't have to be continuous, could be discrete, but in example it's very simple, and it's that does this, that ATV is exponential T, well, you can always rescale T, let me forget about something like this, and then AT has spectrum contained in the unit disk. And V is simple. So we look for an automorphism of the Lie algebra that expands the direction of the vector field and does not expand any other direction. And this is actually what happens in all cases that we can treat. Then if, of course, one immediately say, well, this is maybe too restrictive, and I'm really interested in any opinions about. Well, it's hard to say, because when you have renormalization, then you have to try to prove, you have to try to use it, and until you succeed in using it, It's hard to be sure, at least for me, it's hard to be sure what is the appropriate generalization. And also you need a good example, so I will show you later. Oh, I'm erasing exactly what I shouldn't have erased. So I leave it like this. So, this is what is okay. Okay means, well, okay is just a definition. Okay means that a priori, I call this a priori normalizable. So if you have a situation where your manifold has this structure, a structure is a manifold as a frame of vector fields that of the frame of the tangent bundle that is formed Lie algebra with constant coefficients. So, No. You look at some v from the algebra, and then the v is okay. The v itself is renormalizable, so to speak, at this baby level.
Okay means renormalizable.
But I mean renormalizable at the algebraic level. I mean this doesn't mean that the whole thing is going to work. It just means that you can start at least in this very baby framework. So, I mean, of course, then there will be a lot of other questions that, you know, along the way. V simple means I mean I should say e to the t is simple. So it means that then as an eigenvector of this one parameter group of automorphisms. If there are two directions that are expanded the same strength, this is sounds like trouble. And the rest of the spectrum is indeed exists. It doesn't have to be contracted. In fact, the Heisenberg case, as I show you, is an example where there is a neutral direction that, for some miracle, doesn't bother. But at least this is the setup. So, and let me just anticipate that then the moduli space on which normalization is going to act is just a set. Some set like you take all x with star, so with star on some manifold, and you take a quotient. Roughly speaking, this is what you want to do. So this is the basic idea. This is the moduli space. This is the space where the renormalization dynamics is going to act. So let me explain the obvious. So how these cases fit into this picture? Some almost all are obvious, except maybe for the interest in transformation situation. So okay, of course, if we have two abelian cases. And, well, in the abelian case, if the Lie algebra is abelian, if the manifold as an abelian Lie algebra, an abelian frame, is obvious that this is satisfied, right? So the abelian cases are two, so the integrable so these are tori and the non-integrable, and this is inter-extension transformations. So integrable, non-integrable, and can say the same thing as homogeneous or non-homogeneous. Meaning that, well, there is a Lie structure, but in the case of tori, the Lie structure is really coming from a Lie group. In the inter-extension transformation case, the Lie structure is not coming from a Lie group. It's still abelian, but it's not coming from a Lie group. So this has to do with the fact that so let me briefly explain this. I will come to that more later. So the idea here is that, for instance, if your normalization for inter-extension transformation is considered at the level of surfaces, usually what people use is Teich-Muller flow, which of course is source of motivation for this approach. So Teich-Muller flow lives on a moduli space of Riemann surfaces and H, where H is holomorphic differential, or if you want, you can take M with translation structure. So it's quite clear that either way, you see that there is this abelian frame. The abelian frame is not defined everywhere. It's defined, so it's the abelian frame is defined on M minus a finite set. But this is not, this is not a big deal. I mean, you just want to keep the local behavior of the finite set under close control. And excuse me? Yes. Or the singularity of the flat metric, or so the idea is that, okay, if you don't need to, you can reformulate Knuller flow in this way, that you have a abelian frame, and then you do the obvious one parameter group that you do in R2. Of course, you take e to the t, e to the minus t. This is nothing mysterious. But in Rn, for Rn, then, well, talking about Tn, I don't know of any non-homogeneous example, abelian example in either dimension. There might be, but simply. Well, then you can, there is a full group of possibilities. You can take like e to the t, e to the minus t over n minus 1, something like this. But of course, this is not the only possibility. And well, this is the flow studied by Kleinburg-Margulis and by Kostiakhanin. So in some sense, it's kind of, this is the right thing to do, even this approach includes this case. Of course, this is the baby case. It's just for the linear flow, and then if you want to do more elaborate things, then you get all sort of difficulties along the road. So the SL2R case is also obvious. So I don't even know if I should explain it. But one remark is that in an SL2R, all automorphisms are inner. All automorphisms are inner. So in fact, you take the action of the geodesic flow. Renormalizes your or cycle. So, and also another characteristic. So okay, let me write this down. I'm really ashamed. But essentially, you can look at the Lie algebra. H is your V. The Lie algebra is something like this, and of course you do X H perp into X E T H minus T H perp, and this is the obvious thing to do, and you get the geodesic. And then, with this idea, and very simple idea in mind, you look around for other cases, and you find that there is one other case that is obvious, is the Eisenberg case. And again, I'm kind of ashamed to put it on the blackboard. Oh, by the way, the fact that all automorphisms are inner for me means that there is a moduli space, but it's made of trivial. Every point is a fixed point, because when you quotient by diffeos, since you are acting by diffeos, you're not moving your structure. So all points are fixed points, and so the normalization acts as an operator, just one linear operator on some Hilbert space. But excuse me. Yes. Thank you. There should be a minus sign. And the Eisenberg case is X, Y, equal to z, and then you send x, y, z into etx minus t, y, z. And you look at moduli space of Heisenberg structure on manifolds and etc. And okay, so how much time do I have left? So yeah, so maybe what I'm going to do now is just excuse me. Oh, I'm over time. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought the chances to go over time were reduced, but they are not reduced. They're multiplied by 3. Okay, so let me put at this point among motivations. What I want just to conclude by adding here the fact that there are other simple but interesting situations that. They are kind of homogeneous. I mean, they are kind of algebraic, at least at the level of, you know, you can think of a moduli space and all this. But this approach to normalization breaks down really at the level of finding automorphisms. So this is something needs to be done to generalize this approach that works in this case. So for instance, we can consider beyond for me would mean what we are trying to do now and find effective renormalization for cases like this. One case would be, for instance, higher nilpotent. So you have a Lie algebra which looks like this. This is a very simple, this is the simplest case that already poses problem. So I'm writing just the non-trivial commutators. Instead of stopping at y2, you just go one step more, and you get to y3. So this is, of course, you know, you get a nil manifold, you get quotients of these nil manifolds, you get nil flows. It's known that they are uniquely ergodic. They are related to nk alpha with power 3. And there is no automorphism that does what I said. Well, I should add that actually, I should add here that the determinant of AT, I want it to be 1. I forgot to say this. If AT just delays everything, this doesn't look like kind of a... So what to do in this case? There is another example, which is... this is an homogeneous example. There is a non-homogeneous example, which is also interesting. And the Lie algebra looks like this, so it's x. Well, this is just a flat metric Lie algebra. And I'm sorry, with. So this is 0, and then you have x theta equal to minus x. And this is not equal to plus, and. So. This is just saying that there is a flat metric on a surface, and if you consider this basic structure on for instance on spheres with conical points, you get to Billiards in polygons. So if you have a Billiard in a polygon, or if you have a family of all Billiards in a polygon, I'm not talking about Billiards with rational angles, all Billiards in polygons, you can put them on, you know, you can just do a double and you get a sphere. Geodesic flow in a sphere with flat metric and conical point, and one would like to be able to renormalize that. Nothing is known, so it's a big challenge. And this idea just breaks down miserably because, you know, you certainly cannot find automorphisms that does what you want there. So this is saying we need to go beyond this scheme, automorphism, etc. And of course, it's not clear how, and we need to work out examples. To prove that some generalization actually works. So for today I stop here, and the plan for the next lectures is to see this, well, a little more detail on this, and to see this in action in interval exchange transformation case and I think nilpotent case. The cycle maybe a little. Okay. Sorry for.